Okay, thank you very much for this talk. Now, when I'll be talking to these environmental issues and this indigenous movement in Australia, I'll try to contextualize the data which I collected in this last 6 months, parts of the data, in the context of the social movement literature, and then to look at the whole issues of indigenous movement and how the environmental issues are located within that, the whole interface between this movement and this indigenous issues. Precisely when you look at the social movement literature, we find that a varieties of activities like this protest, of mobilization, collective action, revolts, all are categorized at social movement interchangeably, and this is an inclusive way these are widely used. And in the theoretical perspective, starting from this symbolic interactionist, then to go through this Marxian functionalist classical theorist, and also this resource mobilization and identity theorist, they all always emphasize some varieties of rather certain elements made inbuilt in those kind of activities. Those are usually, they talk about the leadership, the organization, the collective action, the subjectivity, objectivity, the goal orientation. These are part of a social movement analysis. But while doing so, all this perspective, they take into cognizance that these take shape, the leadership, the organization, collective mobilization take shape in a context. And today's world, that context is widely developed by interchangeability, the flow of population and objects, the globalization, and also resurgence of identities at the grassroots and their interconnectivity taking place globally and locally. And also it is taken into consideration so many international pressure is taking place from the above, and also grassroots initiative going to be interlinked with those international pressure. This context is also interlinked with the whole process of historicity, of denial, deprivation, and also revolt and several kind of responses towards that. Now, when we talk about this, the whole perspective, we talk about the indigenous issues, this contemporary world, this is we understand that indigenous issues are intrinsically linked with the whole issue of land, environment, and nature. And it is also related with at the same time, the disposition of this environment, land, culture, everything, a kind of a resistance within that. And movement is generated within the whole process. And this movement is also at times linked with the kind of deliberation taking place at the international scenario and so local grassroots formation. And this movement significantly has not remained isolated from the mainstream. There has been significant civil society intervention and engagement towards the whole process of these indigenous issues. And in the Australian context, to make this issues, that is, it is a lot of historical event made inbuilt while we are understanding the indigenous movement and also the climate issues involved in it. That is, it started with 1788, the process of colonialization, and the whole process goes on in terms of the whole attempt to eliminate them from the society, the process of disposition, and also inflicting several diseases, dislocation, and forced assimilation. And this process continues, and this process perhaps got a new shape in 1960s, a new kind of a change, when they are given the citizenship right, and also they are counted for the first time through referendum in 1967, in the census. Then perhaps 70s and 80s was the landmark in the whole process of mobilization, because this kind of a change came out of a lot of mobilization of the indigenous people. That is, 1970s was the formation of the Coalition for the Land and Land Council. Then 1972, this establishment of the 10th embassy as a protest against indigenous subjugation in the society. It was followed by 1972, that is, Northern Territory Aboriginal 1972 was this Utlam government initiative for a self-determination that paved the way for the emergence of Aboriginal controlled organization, limited rights of ownership of land, allowing the Aboriginal people to make decisions about their own priorities and lifestyle. And it was followed by 1976, that is Northern Territory Aboriginal Land Rights Act, then 1983 NSW Aboriginal Land Rights Act, and the famous 1993 this Native Entitlement Act after this famous Mabo case, and also followed by weak decision 1996 recognized the indigenous rights over the pastoral land. Significantly, two important things took place in 1999 when the Australian Parliament accepted that is the stolen generation, the treatment made to this Aboriginal people was the blemished part of the history, and this 2008 this public apology. The thing that there is a process of shifting of the state attitude towards the Aboriginal people, this attitude shift also linked to the movement was taking place in several parts of the country. And this movement and the state perspective helped certain united protest among the aborigines all over the country. That is this opposition of this Aboriginal, they opposed this this Aboriginal Mourning Day 1938, then the Cook Bicentennial Celebration 1970, then Bicentennial First Fleet 1988. So all those were opposed. Also now a common opposition is stemming in the way of Northern Territory intervention. That is, all over Australia, these indigenous people feel about it, they talk about it, in the media it comes forth. And also recently another common about thing they talk about, the Queensland Wild River Law, whether it should be accepted or rejected. I was reading one of these newspapers, that is Aboriginal Times. There's a lot kind of a debate by a section of the people that is whether it should be or not. So it is through that debate, a kind of engagement of the Aboriginal on the national issues. But simultaneously, interesting fact is that all these are not taking place in isolation. These are taking in the post-Second World War period. It has started from the several international declarations. The declaration comes from this UN Charter that talks about the equal rights and self-determination of all people. Then it is followed by international Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1948, then International Covenant on the Civil and Political Rights, 1966, drafting of UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, 1985, that widely talks about the rights to freely determine their political status, right of autonomy and self-governance, that was a draft widely discussed in UN. And 1986, that is right to development become a inalienable human rights. And it was followed by 1994 again, preparation of the same draft of 1985 on the indigenous right. And 2007 became a landmark when the UN General Assembly accepted this declaration of this indigenous rights and their rights for the self-determination. Australia was one of the four states who objected this declaration. All of us, you know that Australia, New Zealand, America and Canada objected. And perhaps in 2009, it is accepted by Australian Parliament in principle. So all this affected the state functioning. A movement was taking from the below. Also, there was some pressure from the above. They can remain isolated what is taking shape at an international level. So what happened in the whole process, there are several institutional arrangement started taking shape. Those institutional arrangement within this Australia was this land council, three-tier, now this two-tier land council we're talking about. Also this Indigenous Land Corporation is another body. It is established to assist the indigenous people with the land acquisition and land management to achieve economic, environmental, cultural benefits. There is the process of land recovery. There is the Ministry of Indigenous Affairs, the Indigenous Development Program, also Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation, 1991. These are kind of a new arrangement, institutional arrangement taking shape within the state. And this arrangement also taking care of several new policies. I was going through one of the draft of this NSW Aboriginal Affairs Plan 2003-2012. there is an excellent draft. It's available online, and this is, it talks so progressively about the indigenous people, their self-determination, their economic and political life. It talks about the coordination and management of the Aboriginal affairs, strengthen Aboriginal leadership, economic independence, the implement strategies to improve the key social indicators, and also environmental conservation through land council. These are some of the important issues talked about. However, notwithstanding all those initiatives taken by the state, out of a pressure from the below and also some kind of pressure from the above, the indigenous people remain marginalized in Australian society. And this marginalization is both absolute and relative. If you take into consideration at times, that is, it is talked about that the third world existence of the first world population in the developing countries, though it is described of the Aborigines in Australia. We know that Australia is one of the most developed countries in the world. It's having high GDP, like per capita GDP, that is 34,040, that is ranks 6th or 7th in the world ranking. And also it is, educational level is very high, infant mortality is quite low, all those indicators. But if we take that indicator to make an interface of the life of the indigenous people, it appears that they had remained in the periphery of the society. So let me, before going to this, their concern, some of the areas, that is, we know they form this 2.6% of this 20 million population of the state. They are over 20 indigenous people. They have doubled in the last 20 years. That is quite amazing that the number has been doubled in the last 20 years. And 45% living in the regional, 30% in the major cities, and 24% in the rural areas. And interestingly, 86% of them speak in English, and 12% speak indigenous language, because majority of them lost their indigenous language. And then in terms of religion, that is 73% Christian, 24% no affiliation, 1% indigenous, because even the indigenous people, they lost their religious affiliation in the whole process of this forced assimilation. And if we take into consideration, let me go to some of this thing. One of the hope is that indigenous people are having more young population than the non-indigenous people. That is, median age of this indigenous people is 21 years, for them 37 years. Children aged under 15 years, 37% for the indigenous, 19% for the non-indigenous. And people aged 15 to 24, here also again, 19%, and for them 14%. It is that as the age increases, number of the non-indigenous people increases, but number of the indigenous people declines. That is a sign of this, one of the positive signs of this indigenous people. Let us go to the other indicators. In terms of population concentration, we know that there is dispersed population concentration. That is, NSW, it is having the maximum number of indigenous population. That is 29.4% of the population, indigenous population, but it is only 2.3% within its own jurisdiction. It is followed by Queensland, but maximum number of this indigenous people we find concentration is in Northern Territory, and then it is followed by Tasmania. Then it is by Queensland and other places. So there is the unequal dispersal of this population all over the country. Now go to this. Let me go to this educational status. I mean, of this indigenous people. If we look this thing again, we can interpret this data with this several states, seven states together. There is certain variation, but this uniformity comes at the national level. That is, never attended the school, indigenous 2.5%, non-indigenous 0.9%. 5-year-old children attending school 88%, for non-indigenous it is 95%. Retention rate from year 7-8 to 12-year education, that is 46% for the non-indigenous, 76%. Completed year of 12-year of education, that is 22%, that is 47%. Post-school qualification, 25%, 47%. Attending university, 1.7%, and in that case, 4.1%. And 24 years age group attending university and technical education, it is 6% and 25%. But at a lower level, there is equality, but as they grow up, inequality increases among these indigenous and the non-indigenous people. So also the case of this employment and income. Indigenous people, we find that it's 46% in employment, non-indigenous 62% in employment. Unemployed, it is 16%, that is 5%, but yesterday I saw in the newspaper it is 18.1% and 6%, that difference. The not in labor force, that is 46%, for them 23%, and most common employment among those categories, this indigenous is 25%, labor category, for them it is a professional category. And the professionals are the highest median gross weekly income earners, and the laborers are the lowest, but the indigenous people earn 28% less and 16% less in the category of this labor and the professional. There is kind of, again, inequality. The mean gross household income per week for indigenous people, it is $460, and in that case it is $740, and median gross individual income per week, $278, and this is $472. So there is again inequality, visible inequality in the employment and income. Also in the health status, that is quite interesting. Teenaged mothers, in that case, 20%, that is only 4%. Then median age of mothers, 24.7%, that is 30.7%. And also if you compare any international data, higher the extent of education, higher is the age of extent of marriage at the lower age. That is all over the world that is reflected. That is the highest birth rate, fertility rate, that is, it is 24 years, in that case 35 years. Total fertility rates, that is per 1,000 women, that is 2,515, in that case 1,969. Average age of the babies at birth, that is 3 kg, 162 grams, in that case 3 kg, 381 grams. And this is a low birth weight, even in that case 12.5%, it is 5.9%. Life expectancy for the male, it is 67, it is 78 years. In case of female, it is 72.9, this is 82.6. Infant mortality rate, it is 9.7, it is 4.3. Maternal mortality, 21.5, in that case, 7.9. Now overcrowded housing, in the case of the indigenous people, 27%, in that case only 6%. Homeless population, in that case 9%, in that case 2.5%. So if we go by the asset, we know the similar kind of inequalities are also reflected in terms of owning the house and also in the rental accommodation. Also, we find a similar kind of a thing, access over the internet, 43%, 64%. Also, in terms of the income growth. And in terms of registered motor vehicle, quite high in both the cases, so obviously it is. But disparity is at 77%, it is at 90%. Well, I mean, let us see the political and economic representation. In this election, there is only one representative. Maybe it is for the first time in the lower house of the parliament. In the state, for the first time in the lower house. Yeah, in the Senate they have their representation. The lower house for the first time, but they are having representation in the state council. The percentage can be calculated. And recently we find that in the political, there is no national political party for the indigenous people, but there is a formation of recent First Nation political party. It was formed just before the election with the merger of the Ecological, Social Justice and Aboriginal Party. And if we look at the economic care of the total budget of 354.6 billion, budget of this country, only 1.38% is meant for the Aboriginal people. Now, what is happening that this kind of this disparities are widely one is that there is a process of there is inequality, but there is there should be the perception of understanding that inequality. So that perception regarding that inequality is in the increase, and when this inequality is increasing, and that the sense of exclusion is in the making, there is every process that people will try to understand that thing in terms of in the relative terms, and they will try to carve out a space. To explain that, they keep on carve out that space, that understanding of their disposition, understanding of their marginalization and exclusion in terms of the historical disposition from the land, from the culture, from the environment. So here is a tendency that to rebuild that kind of an image, even connecting themselves by land, to the land, by maintaining a relationship between Jimming stories and the spirit of the country. There is a kind of a making. So there is a process of constantly developing a protest against the hegemony of the state. That the process which started perhaps for the first time 1920, that till now keeps on continuing and recirculating in one way or the other. And in the process, there is a kind of intervention and engagement of the trade unionists, the feminists, the student, and the labor in supporting the cause of the indigenous people. And now what is happening that indigenous people now posited with one contradiction, that is contradiction of development versus conservation. That is, and even though it is linked to the whole marginalization, linked to the whole process of colonialism, the question is that whether development as a possible potential to break the barriers of marginalization, or development is a threat to break the link between culture, land and environment and the dream storyline. So there is a contradictory perception even among the indigenous people on this issue. And obviously there is a contradictory response on the part of the indigenous people while going to the field. And those things I keep on explaining, understanding four case studies. One is a Sandon Point development project, housing development project. Then Gandengara, again land council developmental activities focusing on the housing project. Sand mining in Burimai Land Council and Makuri anti-dumping project, where the whole view comes a pro and anti-development dynamics.
In the Kimberley too,
Makoti.
You're thinking of Makoti.
Because I collected the case study mostly from the secondary literature. Also, I met the people. They made a special show in Delhi. In Sydney. They made a special show in Delhi. In Sydney, and so I had the opportunity to interact with them. So also they. Let me come to this Sandon Point. Sandon Point is a big story. It's a story of struggle for more than 1.5 decades, and. It centers around the Sandon Point, that is 61 hectare open space between the coastal village of Thirul and Buli in the northern suburb of Ullangong in the east coast of NSW Australia. And this is initially it was a crown land, and but the land had changed several hands over a period starting from late 1980s. Record shows that initially it was even the Broken Hill company, it was also involved. Later it was Sydney Water, and then Sydney Water sold it to this local Ullangong Land Council, Development Council, and then from there the Stockland purchased the land for the housing development. And now what happened that local people up there, they are having the belief that that land was having more than 600-year-old cultural heritage point, and they found certain skeleton bone and skull there. They believe that it belongs to one of those elderly leader who is considered to be one of the genius of that area, and it is his skull. So they want to preserve it. In that way, they kept on making a protest initially. This protest started from 2001, and gradually, when the No, sorry, Stockland, not Stickland. The Stockland initiated the development project. The Aboriginal people of that area, they constructed a tent embassy in that area, in that place. And they objected, and they started undertaking three different kind of activities. One is that they started undertaking several ceremonial activities. That is, the ceremonial activity was a medium to organize the people and connect the people with the land, culture, and environment. And they want to take into consideration this is a ceremonial place, and sacred fire was burning earlier, and the sacred coal was there, and it is linked to the nature and environment. It is not to be disturbed. And through that ceremony, they keep on taking the sacred fire in several places of the country. The second part is that they take involvement in the legal recourse. That is, they keep on filing the court against the local land and the environmental court. Several times they have got the injunction, so I mentioned all those things. And third part is the picketing and protest. They keep on picketing and protesting regularly in that place, and also 24 hours vigilance, so that the Stockland does not take possession of the land. But the court has given the permission for the construction in 2001. Again, it was stopped. They got some injunction. Again, 2002, court gave the permission to go ahead to this company. And then again, they went to the court. They started construction. And 2005, the important part is that in 2005, one is that is the government made an amendment, but the minister was empowered to take decision. So minister took the decision that is a construction can go ahead. When the minister gave the permission, again they went to the court, local court, with the thing that it is a big threat, environmental threat. So environmental issue, they brought it in the forefront along with the cultural and the heritage issue. The court gave an injunction saying that it can't go ahead, but the minister made an appeal to the Supreme Court saying that it is a development area, it can go. With the minister's appeal was respected, and the Supreme Court gave the decision that construction can go ahead. And then again they made an appeal, the construction was stopped till December 15th of this month. But on July 27, a judgment has come from the court, Supreme Court, that is construction can go ahead. And now the local land council, that is Illawarra Land Council chairperson, Kennedy. The Kennedy started organizing the local people. Also, there is a conference there. There's a what should the local strategy to stop that construction. And they are articulating their issue in terms of environment, culture, and everything, and they stopped that. So what is his view? I had an interview with him, so I want to read it. That is what is going on now. He says that, so what annoyed me is that the government knew what was below the land, but they sold it to the developer. They have done it by ignoring the community concern. In a democracy, you should be listening to the people and not to the developer. You are destroying the natural riverways, the natural habitat, the ecosystem, the ecological community. You are killing it. You are killing it. You add to the depth of the crisis. The white Australia looks down upon the native Australia. You do not respect the land, the plant and the nature. You connect to the land by digging mine, the mineral, taking away all the resources. They take all this to make them rich. Why the Mother Earth be sacrificed to their greed?
Who signed it?
It is Roy Dooch Kennedy, who is the founder of this tent embassy. 24 hours he stays there. And he organizes the local people.
The Illawarra Land Council.
Yeah, chairperson.
Chair.
Yeah. And.
Do you need to read all of it? Do you need to read all of it?
Need to.
Let us read it.
No, I'm reading.
We can read it. It's okay. We can read it.
Okay, we can read it.
Just give us a.
Okay, well, what is important is that two things. One, he is raising the cultural issue. He is taking into consideration the legal recourse and pointing out that you have already made certain law, you are not respecting to the law, you are committed to international convention, you are not respecting the international convention, and also another, it is an interview of 1.5 hours, and he talks about that there is time the government should come and negotiate. So he is opening the path for the negotiation, an institutionalized way to sort out the issue. And there are several sympathizers, so I talked to several people. One is the typical of those sympathizer. He is a local resident of that area. One lady, she talks about the general feeling, that is how they look at the issue. Okay, so this is a view of this one of this. He is non-Aboriginal activist. So he talks about the way that is we keep on giving the lip service, don't take it seriously, and rather it is the time. And that is, they should be given the freedom the way they want to undertake the developmental activities, want to do with the land. So this is one way we are looking at the issue of a development center, where we find an undivided community taking the issue of the environment to protect their heritage, to protect their culture. The second part, I'll go in terms of land claim maintenance and the mining, that is how the land claim is linked to the its maintenance, also mining. At NSW level, we know that there are several claims are there until 2009. 17,137 claims are lost. Of the total claim, 8,655 are determined and 2,319 are granted, and land claims refused, that's 5,348. But the claims undetermined, that is yet under yet to be decided, that is 9,087. So there is a huge kind of a land claim. Now it is initiated in recent years, and state is also responding to that. Now, one of those land council, that is Uriemai Aboriginal Land Council. This is one of the. It is considered to be one of the most enterprising land council. In the Northern Hemisphere.
Southern
Hemisphere, not South.
Where is that?
It is not the Southern, Newcastle. Yeah. Newcastle's.
No, you mean North of Sydney?
Yeah, North of Sydney, yeah.
I thought we were the Northern Hemisphere.
There is a Southern Hemisphere. It is a talk of Southern Hemisphere. okay, so they have got a total of 153 plots for of conservation land, making an application for 155. But this Uriemai Land Council has got the dubious distinction: on the one hand, enterprising; on the other hand, highly corrupt, inefficient. And they must to be bankrupt twice, because they invested some money in certain to make some amusement park. They failed to undertake it, so they have to sell certain plot to give money back to that corporation. Also, there is one member of that land council who happens to be very corrupt, and there is an independent commission against corruption was it investigated, and he was removed from there. And now they undertake two important activities. One is the activity is the Sun Dome touring. I mean, if all of you must have gone and visited places, a beautiful scenic place, lot of sand dunes and like this, and the sand dune is gradually coming towards this green areas. That is one of the thing they keep on talking about, and that sand dune, one of those things is that they consider that is Stockstone Bright is a part of this Uriemai Land Council. It is given for sand mining. It is given to one of the company, and that will make a good amount of money. And money, the sand will be extracted from two sites. That is, the sites are of that is 1,826 hectare Uriemai National Park, or another site of this 1,042 hectare Uriemai State Conservation Area, and another area also identified that is 1,560 hectare Uriemai Regional Park. So these are identified from where those sand will be taken, and sand will be taken for development purposes in Sydney and Newcastle, and they will be earning £15 per tons of sand, and in a year that land council will earn roughly around $30,000, and it will generate roughly around 30 to 60 contract and permanent employment for the local people. So it this action is initially taken, and local land council, all the members, those who are there, they unitedly supported this move because it will give them certain revenue that will be using for the purpose of the housing, health, employment, and other developmental programs. But technically, they don't call it mining; they call it an extraction, because mining is having a legal complication. So they call it extraction like this. But there has been certain opposition. Opposition is done by the traditional owner of the country, that is Carol Rigby. She considered the traditional inheritor of that plot and her community, and they are not part of the land council. So she organized a movement, a protest rather, initially, with the local people, local environmentalists, and some other people there. And what she says that is the problem is that the Land Right Act is that it can let the people who don't necessarily have any link with the land to take control of the land. That is really important to the genuine traditional owners. You know it better how the land council functions. That is, people, 10 people, indigenous people, claiming their heritage, can develop a trust. Land Council Development Trust and in that area, then through a democratic process, they can go ahead claiming the land. So this Land Council, she says that when this it is done, but the people are not really representing the community. The act dispossesses the traditional owners and leads to the destruction of the heritage, an ancient landscape of her ancestor. It is full of bones and artifacts of my people, and who knows how much and how many have already been crushed and destroyed by the mining. The miners will do their heritage, because there is a process that heritage report is to be developed, an archaeological report is to be developed, also an anthropological report is to be given, and those are done by the miners themselves. It is not required that the community will give. Now, once she has challenged, she finds that she is to give a counter report that is to be done by some archaeologist she appointed. So she's finding it is quite challenging. It needs a lot of money. She's not having those kind of money, but she is pressurizing. The opposite view that is given by Smith, Andrew Smith, he's the chairperson of the Land Council. He says that the extraction would done only very strict plan of heritage management. Funds that will flow from the sand extraction would be used to provide the variety of benefits, including housing and health services. And he finds himself in a very contradictory position. He finds that he respects the indigenous culture, indigeneity, environment, nature, everything. But he also says that development is a part of life. You can't deny that. He says that we don't wear lap-laps or live in the dunes now. And we live in the houses, drive cars, watch TV. The state government is screaming out for sand, and we can earn money for our people by providing it. So what he's saying, there is a pressure from the government to be self-sufficient. You have got the resource, your developmental project, you earn the money, undertake the developmental project. So maybe one of the pressure is that he is undertaking those developmental activities, and because once you are in land council, there is also politically correct, because you want to satisfy the people. So he is part of this developmental initiative. So with the environmentalist also different kind of a view. And also several people, they keep on protesting that this area should not be taken. So environmentalists usually keep on opposing this project. They take the sign of Carol, anti-Carol, they call anti-Carol, like this. So anti-Carol, that one of our interviews, the way she articulates now, should I read, or you will read this thing? Maybe what she said, she just reflected here, the same thing. Now, as a strategy to get this land back, what she does, that she's now engaging one archaeologist. Now she's lobbying lobbying with the ministers. She's saying a law is already passed by the NSW parliament saying that land is to be given to this traditional clan. So traditional clan living within that community should be respected. That she said that October 31st is the date when this bill will come. She's also using the new media. She has constructed one website to give all this information. She is also appealing the federal minister with the member of the community. They're also they have made several physical demonstrations expressing their opposition of this using the sand mine for the any developmental purpose. Pro-development, usually this is the view of Andrew Smith and other members, those who are present. Actually what he told, same thing, he is saying that is it is interesting. I mean, he is saying the world is not big enough. We are part of this assimilation. And two parties, interesting of his talk and his when I interviewed him, he was clearly talking about he wants the natural habitat be maintained. Simultaneously, he wants there is to be development. But when we have to develop, we can't remain isolated from the mainstream of the society. So he finds himself in the thick of certain dreams. His dream is that part is to be developed, communities to be educated, everything's to be done. And he organized one 7-day workshop on climate change in this area to by inviting all the youth of that area, what is the climate change, how it can be protected. And he is going to initiate several wind energy driven electricity program there. So that's why he has taken certain initiative, that is he wants that development to be done. He can make this eco-friendly development. So he's trying to make a compromise between the development and conservation. That is his view. So similar view, we look at the Gandangara Liverpool kind of a thing. This is also one of the very vibrant organization. And they're working very seriously on the employment, education, health, and age care, and also housing. And they have got twice recognition from the state government for the developmental activities they are doing, especially for the land care system. They have made one monument, the Botanical Gardens, garden memorial to the stolen generation, also cultural awareness program. And housing project is one important that they have initiated a housing project on the land which they have got. And they say that by getting the money from the housing project, they want to use it for the other developmental purposes. And fortunately, there has not been any opposition to that project. And but they want more money, more kind of assimilation. And they want one lady I interviewed, that she's one of the members, Carol Brown. I want to say that the Aboriginal people should be developed by their own right. We should have best of both culture, Aba Gaba, that is both the culture it should have. And the mother, my mother was a native, father was an Irish, and we have taken both of the culture. We attach ourselves to both the culture. And she finds that is whatsoever the activities done by this land council for the development, it is to be encouraged and appreciated. Now, I happened to interview there another person who was a member of the stolen generation. She herself was taken away, kept in a church. Her son was taken away, and she could get her son back after 52 years. The son is in Brisbane now, and what she says that is there should be a process of compensation, and compensation is given in monetary terms, and she says that it should be given in terms of land. Land is given so that they can maintain that land, the cultural heritage, so that people should know both the culture. The new generation does not know, because many of those people, as they have grown in the missionaries and other places, they have lost the touch of the culture. So they should be taught the cultural practices. So there has been they have started a school there in this Gandangara, and that school they usually teaches the cultural practices, the moorings, others of this Aboriginal people. So that also I find a kind of a pro-development assimilationist approach with the development, and without much of a contradiction. within the given universe, as I have said. Now, the third case is the case of nuclear waste dumping in the Northern Territory. That is widely talked about in the media. And that is in December 2005, the federal government of Australia passed the legislation to force a national nuclear waste dump on the Northern Territory, despite opposition from Aboriginal landowners and the Northern Territory government and the environmentalist group. And it was decided that Makute Station, 120 kilometers up north in the Northern Territory, that is Tennant Creek, it will be established, and 130 truckloads of radioactive waste would be driven from Sydney Locust Height Reactor to NSW in the first year, so it will continue for 10 years. So that is one of the thing, and it is thought of that is as the government is having several international obligation, and this idea is identified that is other also feels that is so many other used uranium will be dumped there. So that is another kind of apprehension. That is what you talked about the environmentalist group. So the Australian Greens, the Friend of Earth, the Wilderness Society, the Northern Territory Labour Conference, all those keep on helping it, joining the protest against that. And the community leaders, they're having their own kind of a voice to talk about it. It is traditional owner of this land is the Nagappa traditional owners. There are 32 owners. Now it is said that one part of the Northern Land Council members, they have agreed to give the land with the prospect that they will be getting certain good amount of money, and that money will be invested for the development. So there is a process of financial gain to get out of that. There is only one section. The government says that that part was considered. Government also undertakes that position that is a federal law always prevail over the Northern Territory law, because even the Northern Territory already passed a resolution opposing this mine, but the federal law is going to prevail over that. So it is going to start functioning. And the every party, I mean those whom we met here, they are having their own voice. That is, it is to be stopped. When this Sydney, they came. Okay, that's the next page. So what they are doing, interestingly, they are lobbying as an activity. They are lobbying with the ministers, the federal ministers. They are also mobilizing the public opinion. They are having a small truck with a good decoration, moving from one part of the country to another. That they came from Sydney. They came from one part to Sydney, stayed there whole night. Next day they have to go to Canberra. So they are making the public mobilization of the public opinion, and they are saying they are moving all over the country to unite the indigenous population on the issue. That is, it is a common issue of the indigenous people. They should not be robbed of their land and other kind of a thing. And the community leaders, those who are here, I have recorded, so just two sentences put here. The dumping site, if at all going to be established on the identified side of Makute, it is to be established only on our dead body. I mean, they are so strong, so emotionally attached to that, they will not allow it to happen. And part is that they were here and they went there on August 17. They were in Canberra, and they have already filed a suit in the Supreme Court. They hired a lawyer, and the case will be heard in the 1st of October. That is whether it will go ahead or not. So that is in a process. Now the whole process, if we look into, interestingly, is that something comes, this development, conservation contradiction, the nature-culture contradiction, is that the indigenous movement now it has been widely institutionalized, and it is following a path of institutionalized movement, and this institutionalization is taking shape in the process of in the form of filing the suit, going to the court, lobbying, making a recognized kind of protest like this. So we find that the indigenous movement now is at a crossroad, and simultaneously takes into consideration two things. One is that development versus conservation. So what I find that in the context of persistent marginalization of indigenous identities, now the indigenous identities are rejuvenated, linking their historical association with land, traditional culture, and environment. Because this movement, the way they protested and came out, it is not in isolation from this, their own feeling of their land and development. So it is widely linked and coming in the process. The third thing is that as the rejuvenated identity use the state-provided space to articulate protest against existing and perceived discrimination, the grassroots protests have got linked with wider society. It is not that they have remained isolated in the whole process of mobilization. The identity is not getting quite linked with the wider society. It is at time engaging with the trade unionist, engaging with this environmentalist, though in a limited way. It is not that everywhere they have got the support, and but there is a process of engagement. That engagement is becoming at a national level. Now, fourth thing is that a rejuvenated identity within the given context of institutionalized arrangement function both as a mechanism of institutionalization and limited self-determination. That is, it's quite interesting. That is, land council has emerged, and other things, those kind of institutional arrangement has emerged out of certain movement of those indigenous people. But this institution now widely used as a mechanism to co-opt the indigenous movement, which is taking place at the grassroots and becoming functioning of the state. So it's a kind of gradual expansion of the state institutional mechanism from center to the regional and then to the grassroots level. So it is a kind of a way of institutionalizing the movement. And next thing is that linking localized indigenous identity with pan-Australian indigenous identity is in the making. Through the common concern of common experience of history and contemporary marginalization and common concern of culture, heritage, and nature. The common pan, I'm having a doubt whether it is in the making. But I find that there is some symptom to see to it. The kind of a pan-Australian kind of indigenous identity is in the making. That is, though it started in 1970s, so this indigenous tent embassy, that is a kind of a thing. Mebo case and this federal law is another. Also, government has asked for several apology and also the reconciliation motion. But now, there is a common experience of deprivation, common experience of isolation and exclusion. That is giving them a common sense to locate themselves in a position where they can remain isolated but link them with national kind of a framework and simultaneously linking them with culture, environment, and society. Because all this movement, even development, they have not shown disrespect to environment. They want to maintain the environment and development be within that. And the developmental need injected culture of opposition and solidarity that negotiate with land, environment, and culture. Now, developmental need, I find that whatsoever the opposition, a solidarity we are thought of is the concrete homogeneous group, but development has made in two cases at least, in case of the Urimi and in case of Makoti, it shows that there is a kind of diversification among these communities. That community, whether they will take care of the interest or identity, there is a kind of confusion. This confusion is also in the making, and that is making at a national scale. And last thing is that, the state in the globalized world is posited with climate crisis, the climate change, and obligation for self-determination of the indigenous people. Hence, they create the mechanism of what I told earlier. It is again reinforcing that the state is also in the globalized world is faced with two kind of a problem. One is that they have to respond to the climate change, that issue. Also, they have to respect to the various international conventions. And here is a common point of indigenous people, that is by co-opting the various mechanisms that of this indigenous people, it can be responded towards that. Because if indigenous lifestyle and indigenous institution are taken into cognizance, many of the environmental issues can be also tackled. So that part can also be can be developed further. I can argue that one better. And last part is that the issue of the interest and identity. When you talk about the indigenous people or indigenous group, what is the common point that will club them together? Because initially we started with that argument that is all varieties of this protest, opposition may be considered as a movement. Yes, we can consider it as a movement. But there is, in terms of identifying the collectivity, the problem is that what is the common point of identification? Should we identify them in terms of a common identity, the ethnic identity, ecological identity, or in terms of certain interest? Many a time, in the process of negotiation with the development, it is the interest is become a priority rather than the identity. But that has also been at a superficial level. It comes that identity has remained, even in the case of Urimi and then Makoti, that identity has remained because it is only the limited number of people they are talking about the development. Even if they are talking about the development, they are not talking about the destruction of the nature. So indigenous identity is also prevailed. So I like to just conclude, leaving that open for discussion, that is, in contemporary world, when you talk about the social movement, there has been a decline of all these conventional varieties of this movement. Trade union movement is in the decline, farmers and the agricultural laborers movements are in the decline, but two movements are in the increase. One is that is environmental movement, and second is the indigenous people's movement. The indigenous people's movement is taking place widely in the context of deprivation, historical experience of injustice, and that is widely in the making, and these movements are going to sustain when they are getting an interface with the environmental issues. And if the state is unable to address in terms of the international convention and also local need at the grassroots, it will be difficult to resist the culture of an exclusion of the excluded by the excluder. If a culture of the exclusion is created by the indigenous people, it is being created based on the historical experience. If the culture of exclusion is also promoted, it is promoted based on the own association with the land and environment. If state, by giving priority to the development, is rejecting the development, and if the state is giving priority to the development at the cost of a nature, they are also showing disrespect to the indigenous community. So here is to make a balance to see to it that a culture of exclusion of the excluded by the excluded themselves is not promoted. So maybe I'll stop here.